Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. My, how time flies when you're having fun. It's been a whole year since our North Louisiana friends at Red River Radio welcomed Louisiana Eats onto the airwaves there. So this week, we're spending the whole show investigating the burgeoning food and drink scene of our neighbors in the North. Visionary farmer Evan McCommon of Mahaffey Farms is doing some pretty innovative work on his family's farm. Evan gives us a tour and even introduces us to his heritage breed pigs. Then Andrew Nations of Great Raft Brewery explains what makes their locally brewed beer so good. It's one big North Country celebration on this week's Louisiana Eats.
If I start focusing on money and wealth building, I think I'll neglect the principles that are going to build it the right way. I didn't get into this to get rich, but I think we can build something that can take care of our family.
That's Evan McCommon on his family's land, Mahaffey Farms. Located outside of Bossier City, Mahaffey Farms has been in Evan's family since 1927 and thrived as a working farm for decades before Evan's great uncle passed away.
The path of least resistance was, if these pine trees are trying to grow here, let's let them do it. So we started raising pine timber.
Which they grew until the timber economy bottomed out a few years ago.
I'm like, what are we going to do? You know, I had all my eggs in one basket. So how can I diversify? How can I figure out other ways to keep this family land alive and invigorate it?
Evan started looking for solutions and found that the most diverse farms were usually on savanna pastures.
Basically what savanna means is widely spaced trees. That a forest is a dark, foreboding, dark place, you know, and really savanna has grass, has multiple layers of different size plant species growing together. And it's actually because of that, you basically have more surface area and you're collecting more solar energy than any other system on the planet in a savanna, which supports more species. There's the three major environments of forest, open land, and water. And where the three of those come together is where you're gonna have the most abundant life. So we're trying to create as much of that as possible. And the savanna is the most abundant life-producing system we can mimic in nature.
So he started the conversion, trimming back trees and clear-cutting some dense forest. But the land was always Evan's first priority.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, we're starting to see results. If you look over there, I mean, literally, I think maybe we're pushing 8 months now, that was just thick pulpwood pine. And look at it, it's just chest-high grass with dappled oaks, and the oaks are going to provide master forage for our pigs.
Evan modeled his North Louisiana farm after Joel Salatin's Polyface Farms in Western Virginia. You may know Joel Salatin from The Omnivore's Dilemma and Food, Inc. Joel offers internships for aspiring farmers at Polyface Farms, and Evan was fortunate to have studied there with the legendary farmer.
I'm not bashful about saying I copied everything exactly almost. The way I built my pens, the way I built my eggmobile. And that's kind of like, you know, well, you know, you're just copying Joel Salatin. Well, yeah, that's like a basketball player copying Michael Jordan, of course.
Exactly. No need to reinvent the wheel.
No. And
if
it's working
great. If you learn from the master.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're making adjustments for our southern climate. You know, it's a little bit different than the Shenandoah Valley here. A little bit different soil, a little bit different heat. And so just little minor changes.
One of the big things he's adopted is a group of movable pasture pens for his chickens, known as chicken tractors. They're 10 by 12 foot shelters made out of aluminum siding that come up to your knees.
And the way they work is you move the chickens every day, and this gets them access to fresh green grass on pasture, bugs, the environment that a chicken's supposed to be in and the nutrition that they're supposed to get. Instead of being locked in a dark house on top of their own excrement, these are moved every day to fresh, clean ground off of yesterday's manure. And the way Joel Salatin designed them was also a production method to where you can go out and one person can move 1,000 birds in half an hour. And so this is about 300 birds, and I can move them in about 20 minutes. And that includes feeding them, watering them, moving the pens, everything.
But chickens aren't the only animals Evan's raising on the farm. He's got cattle, goats, and pigs.
We have four groups of pigs on the farm right now. And we don't just raise red wattles. Like I said, I'm into hybrid vigor. We have a lot of crossbreeds. We have red wattles mixed with Hampshires and blue butts. And we have some pure red wattles, and some of them are, we don't even know. Just pigs. A pig is a woodland creature. They are exceptionally good at taking, putting them in the forest and turning the soil over and creating just the right amount of disturbance to invigorate for us converting from timber or in forest to a savanna pasture. They're the perfect animal to help us do the work.
Pigs are an important part of the mix at Mahaffrey Farms. Some were feeding in their pens while others roamed free, grazing in the shade of the tall pines.
I like to look at old livestock books and see what did the pigs look like back in the 1920s and 30s. Because back then, you know, there hadn't been bred for confinement facilities. Everybody was raising pigs outside. Let's just find old genetics, closest to the wild source. That's another way to look at it. This is where they're meant to be. There's a reason why a pig has a plow on the end of its nose. It's so that it can forage for roots and bugs and all these different things. I like flavor in my food, and raising things on pasture and letting the animals get to maturity. A 300-pound pig rather than a 200-pound pig actually develops a better flavor over time, especially when you finish them with acorns or on pasture with real green forage and real food instead of just corn. And that's what their meat's supposed to taste like.
As much as possible, Evan lets Mother Nature do the heavy lifting while he attends to the farm's management.
So, like, if you add pigs to your operation, that encourages 8 more species, or it will support them. So by putting these pigs here, we're going to bring in different types of birds that we're going to, you know, rely on them for different things, and different insects and different plants are going to thrive with the addition of each species. So I'm excited about having just thousands and thousands of, I want this place to be just the Garden of Eden is what I'm trying to build.
As we crossed back through the chicken pasture, we got a great overview of Mahaffrey Farms. A small lake was to our right, the savanna pasture to our left, and a dense timber forest could be seen on the horizon. Of the 1,100 acres available, only 300 have been converted to farmland.
We're still going to keep timber as our mainstay, and that's our primary product. And if this continues to expand, you know, in 10 years from now, this 300 acres will be a very prosperous savanna. And then we'll be looking at the next block of land that's adjacent and say, okay, where is it in the management plan? Is it ready for some thinning and savanna work? That's the thing, it's a really a legacy for me, is that my uncle left this for us. He left this thing, and the family, not by any fault of our own, but just no one was here to do it. And so now I'm taking over and saying, okay, we're going to keep this family legacy in this farm, and we're going to turn it into something that we're proud to pass on. And then I'm happy to see something real get done with it instead of it turning into another real estate development. We don't want to see more suburban sprawl. We want to see sustainable agriculture sprawl is what I want to see.
Evan McCommon sells fresh produce and pastured meats at farmers markets in the greater Shreveport area. You can also buy directly from his family's farm in Princeton, Louisiana. Visit MahaffreyFarms.com for more information. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. After a short break, we move from the farm to the city of Shreveport, where youth and community gardens are sprouting up in urban locations all across the city. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. The Shreveport food scene is really on the move. Some of the most innovative work designed to provide fresh food access is happening in urban locations all across the city.
My name is Grace Peterson. I'm an extension agent with the LSU Ag Center, and I work with youth and community gardens around the Shreveport-Bossier area, and I also work with establishing a healthy regional food system for the Arklatex.
That's the tri-state area of Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, which Grace knows very well. She leads a team at the Valencia Youth Garden and Urban Farm in Shreveport, one of 15 gardens she manages in the area. As you can imagine, that amount of work keeps her busy.
The programming we do here is pretty extensive. We offer after-school programs for kids of all ages. What that brings in is gardening lessons, cooking lessons, and lessons about the food system so that the teenagers understand what it takes all the way from seed to plate, and also what are the barriers to access to nutritious food. And we've identified that there's four major barriers. One is physical access, which would be food deserts. There's not a healthful food outlet in your neighborhood. Financial access, maybe you can't afford nutritious food. And two knowledge barriers, one being the knowledge of what to eat that's healthy, and the other is how to prepare it in a healthy way. So we help the teenagers and the younger kids learn this.
When you meet Grace, it's apparent that she's laid back. She's got a wonderfully disarming presence and a practical sensibility to match. Grace is helping solve legitimate problems in many of Shreveport's underserved communities. Here she is touring the garden.
You know, what I find, you know, I'm not originally from Shreveport, but I've been here for 25 years now. And I find that once people really understand the issues, they're very generous with time and money. But I find that the environment's very receptive, and I think great things are happening. In fact, what I see here is that we're able to have a concerted effort towards the food system, the regional food system, and some of these programs because people are really working together.
And of all the things Grace is working on, that regional food system might be the biggest.
If we're ever going to get farm to institution, more farm to restaurant, we need to look at a systems approach to that. First, we look at the food system and how can that system be supported on a regional level so that we can support more food producers and then get to that point where food is available at many, many outlets.
Those ambitions have a long way to go, so Grace focuses on the neighborhood level first.
And what we found when we started looking into that is we've lost the infrastructure for the processing and distribution of regionally grown food. You know, we have a farmer's market, which is really great, but if we're going to get it to where enough can go into schools and institutions, then we need a regional food hub, like a wholesale hub, where food can be aggregated, processed, packaged, and then distributed. And when you look at a regional food system, you're typically looking at a metropolitan center and then 100 miles out. So for us, it's Shreveport-Bossier and what's called the Arklatex. So we're going to be looking at how do we work with three states to do that, and how can we really get funding to get this regional food hub, but also starting at the neighborhood level so that we can help people understand the issues and provide education so that the general public can advocate for a healthy regional food system. So we're developing these neighborhood food hubs such as Valencia and Highland, where we can really provide programming so that people understand the issues, and then they can become advocates and spokespeople for the development of this system.
Those pragmatic ideas have attracted people to the Valencia Youth Garden since it was founded 5 years ago. In that time, Grace has seen all kinds of transformations take place. A lot of them are because of her, like the way she got kids to enjoy vegetables, something parents often try to do, but usually fail at.
Well, you know, one of the best things that we've done is use a taste test form. And so whenever they're trying something new, you know, well, first of all, we had to outlaw the word nasty. Like, no, we're not going to talk about our food that way, because a lot of people look at it and decide they don't like it before they even try it. So we have this form. And so I said, okay, before you decide anything, you look and you get to judge this on a scale of 1 to 5 on the color. Do you like the way it looks? And they can judge that. And now, nope, don't eat it yet. Now smell it. Do you like the way it smells? And then we talk about texture, and they put it in their mouth and decide if they like the texture and then the taste. So it gives them the control and also lets them decide and get their senses involved in it before they just make a blanket decision that they don't care for it. They can really start interacting and forming that relationship with something new.
But the adults are another story.
Kids are very interested in growing things and preparing that, but adults who've never gardened before seem to not be so interested. So I found that it works better to bring them in through the fresh food aspect of it. And so one program we've done to bring in the families is a veggie of the month, where we invite the families to come and actually harvest a crop and then go up and all prepare it together. And as a way to encourage the adults to get more involved in the garden. Another challenge has been that sometimes the kids learn how to cook, but they're not making the choices at the grocery store. So we give them a certificate to take home that tells what they know how to do in the kitchen, and take home some recipes, and also take home, you know, ingredients that we have from the garden, and encourage the parents to purchase the rest for that recipe.
Grace hopes that increasing the awareness of what's communally available will also increase the demand of those foods. With one unexpected challenge after another, the job is far from glamorous. But when things go well, it's got its perks.
You know, once they get involved with it and really start tasting these things, it does seem that that they are making changes. It's just that, you know, changing what we eat doesn't happen quickly. So I always think in baby steps. And, you know, if one of the first thing that families do is add fresh vegetables from the garden to their ramen, making a vegetable soup, I think that's a step in the right direction. And we encourage those kind of small steps. The whole culture of this community center has changed around food, and the peer pressure is towards the garden and towards trying new things. And it's great to hear the kids now, when new ones come in, the ones who've been involved in the program will say, oh no, we don't say that about our food. No, and how are you gonna know if you don't try it? And so they're starting to say those kind of things. It's baby steps, it is, but progress, yay.
That's Grace Peterson, member of the LSU Ag Center and leader of the Valencia Youth Gardens and Urban Farms in Shreveport. Since we last spoke with her, Grace has received a grant from the USDA, which will expand the organization into 3 more community centers in Shreveport. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Chris Jay is a food blogger for the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourism Bureau. His weekly blog, covering the food scene in northwestern Louisiana, can be found each week on 20by49.com. Chris is also our intrepid roving reporter and has recently been researching stuffed shrimp. It's hard to overstate the impact that stuffed shrimp has had on Shreveport's Black community. This distinctive regional food has launched careers, revitalized city blocks, and put kids through college. But its origins are contested. When Chris Jay went looking for answers, his travels took him to Eddie's Restaurant, said to be the home of Shreveport's original stuffed shrimp.
If you go looking for an explanation as to why every soul food diner in Shreveport sells stuffed shrimp, which aren't normally a mainstay on soul food menus, you eventually end up at the late chef Eddie Hughes.
He established Eddie's Restaurant in 1978 here in Shreveport, Louisiana, Hollywood and Union. He started his affiliation with Freeman and Harris when he was 12 years old. He was a foster kid. They felt sorry for him and put him to work.
That's Gino Hughes, Eddie's son and one of several Hughes children who continue to operate Eddie's Restaurant. Mavis Thigpen, Gino's sister, believes that her father introduced stuffed shrimp to the menu at Freeman and Harris Cafe, a now-shuttered soul food mecca on Shreveport's west side. This would have been in the 1950s, after Eddie returned from a stint as an Army cook.
He was in Germany. He was in the Army, the service, and he cooked there. But no, he didn't bring it back. He actually kind of created this when he was 17 years old at the old Freeman and Harris. And he kind of perfected it once he left and went to the service and came back and then really dedicated his time and service to the old Freeman and Harris.
I have interviewed roughly a dozen black chefs and cooks about the origin of these stuffed shrimp. I asked each of them who created the original recipe, and I never heard the same answer twice. I had similar results when I asked about the ingredients.
But it is a crab meat base along with my dad's own secret ingredients. You know, he showed quite a few how to make it, but he didn't show them everything that he put in. We have the original recipe handwritten. My mother has that my father had. So we're holding on to that original handwritten recipe.
Driving through the Allendale neighborhood, you see stuffed shrimp everywhere. They're painted on the sides of cafes, advertised on sandwich boards. I'd guess that there are two dozen or more soul food places boasting stuffed shrimp as their house specialty. Mention this to Gino Hughes, and you can practically see his blood boil.
These other people, I don't know anything about them. I think they're Johnny-come-latelys, and good luck to them.
I can't say for sure that Eddie Hughes invented the distinctive stuffed shrimp that became soul food in Shreveport, but I can say that Eddie's Restaurant is a great place to see his legacy in action. Three generations of the Hughes family work here, serving up order after order of stuffed shrimp prepared the way that Eddie would have prepared them, for the most part.
My sister recently has stepped into the business more forcefully. And she has a variation of stuffed shrimp, which is very similar to the product that I produce. They're not the same. She and I differ on that matter a little bit, too. I think hers is good, and I think mine are better, of course. But I think the closest that you're going to get to the original stuffed shrimp would be at Eddie's.
For Louisiana Eats, I'm Chris J.
That's Chris J., our Shreveport roving reporter.
You can come and ask me, goes to Charlotte. I got rhythm. Where's supposed to be? If you want to come in, it's a soul like me. Come on, baby, come along with me. Catch a little taste of soul.
Chef Jeff Henderson is a television personality who hosts the daytime TV show Flip My Food, which gives iconic American comfort food a healthier twist. When the show's food truck made a visit to Shreveport to shoot an episode, news of their arrival got to Eddie's Restaurant, and they immediately sent some of their legendary shrimp over for Jeff to sample. Jeff was so wowed by the taste, he contacted Mavis Thigpen of Eddie's Restaurant, and much to her delight, asked her to be a guest on Flip My Food.
One thing I love about Flip My Food is that I have a love affair and connection to ordinary people, real stories. We go in inner city communities, we go in the suburbs, we visit restaurants. It's not a high-end cooking show, it's comfort food, the food that most Americans love to eat. I just flip them, make them a little bit healthier and tastier. You know, I was recently in Shreveport, and I met a woman down there named Mavis, And she has a family secret recipe that they even had the lawyer and a security guard come up in to flip my food truck to make sure no one got that recipe. But she made her version and I made a version. So I made like a lighter version, a tempura, fried the shrimp in grapeseed oil. And I use a light crab meat in mine. And I did have one egg in there. And I took the Holy Trinity, put that in there, and some special little Cajun seasoning. And I butterflied the Gulf shrimp, and I packed in that little crab stuffing I made. And I took two wilted chives and tied them in a little bow so they wouldn't fall apart, dipped them in my little batter, and I fried it.
What was her reaction to your flipped shrimp?
Well, she really was intrigued by my technique. But you know, down in New Orleans, down in the South, and where your show airs, it's not about the presentation, it's about the flavor. So at the end of the day, you know, her shrimp beat mine by a long shot. I mean, the flavor, I just couldn't figure out what she had up in there. It must have been some of that bayou or some alligator or something up in there. But it was like mouth-watering, let me tell you.
Jeff shares a lot more than cooking tips with his guests. Healthy living is an important part of his message. But what he's really all about is helping people succeed at their own goals. A lot of his good deeds aren't to impress a television audience. As with any TV production, there's a lot of downtime, and Jeff uses that time to really get to know his guests, spending the time between takes freely sharing his knowledge about the restaurant business, which is just what he did with Mavis at Eddie's.
I spent a little time with them and really tried to help them understand how this whole marketing and getting your product out there game. You know, I told her at some point in your life, you're going to have to give up the recipe to mass produce it to get it to the masses. Sometimes folks in rural communities and small town America hold on to things their whole life. You know, you got to let it go at some point. You know, you can't trademark recipes, you know, so find you a manufacturer who can mass produce it for you. You do the profit sharing and you put Eddie's famous stuffed shrimp, grocery stores all across America. All you need is somebody to say, we like that and we want to put it in all our restaurants all across the country. And there you're set to go now. They were like, their eyes got big, my visa's eyes said, oh, I don't know if we can. I said, well, something you need to consider. I mean, you want to grow. And the only way people are going to know about Eddie's restaurant and their legendary stuffed shrimp is you have to take it, the product, across the country. Everybody knows about it in Shreveport. Everyone loves it there, but folks need to know about it in California, New York, all throughout the South. And that's how you build your reputation and get folks seeking it out. So everybody can't come to Shreveport. So you have to send Shreveport to them. And so it creates you a nice little box, get your logo, and dry ice it, figure out how you can ship that. But as a small operator, it's a challenge when you don't have the equipment and the manpower to do that. But there's quite a few manufacturing companies out there that you buy so many units, and they will make, package, and ship for you. And you just wait for your check to come on the 1st and the 15th of every month.
So will we ever see Eddie's famous stuffed shrimp mix on the shelves of the grocery store? Only time will tell. If you want to try your hand at stuffed shrimp, stay tuned, and I'll share my recipe with you. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Brace yourself as the beat hits you. Dip, trip, get Fantasia. The folks at Eddie's restaurant won't give up their secret recipe for stuffed shrimp, but I'll give you mine. The provenance of my recipe is Rudy Lombard's classic cookbook, Creole Feast, where 15 master chefs of New Orleans share their secrets with the world. Wearing chef's whites and a towering toque, Chef Nathaniel Burton gazes out from the book's cover. His stuffed shrimp recipe, which appears in Creole Feast, inspired my version. The first time I ever fried up a batch, I called my friend Leah Chase and told her about the delicious stuffed shrimp I'd made, explaining that I used Chef Nathaniel Burton's recipe. Leah scoffed. That's not Nathaniel's recipe. It's mine. That's how it goes in the restaurant business. You can't copyright a recipe, and staking claim to one is a dubious challenge. So I'll say my version is inspired by Chef Nathaniel Burton and just what you can still order today from Leah Chase at Dookie Chase's restaurant. If you want to try them at home, here's what you do. First, buy the biggest, freshest shrimp you can find. Peel them, leaving the tails intact. Then butterfly them by splitting them from top to tail along the natural inside curve, taking care not to cut through the shrimp entirely and removing the vein at the same time. Saute green onions, celery, bell pepper, and garlic in butter until they're soft. When the seasonings are done, stir in claw crab meat. Nothing makes a better dressing than New Orleans French bread. Wet the bread thoroughly with water and chop it fine before stirring it into the crab meat mixture along with freshly chopped parsley. Season your stuffing with salt and pepper and then pack about a tablespoon of it into each shrimp. Roll the shrimp in flour, then in egg wash, and finally dredge them in dried breadcrumbs. Heat your oil to 360 degrees and fry the shrimp till they're browned. When you serve them, say it's your recipe. I'll never tell. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Nathaniel Burton's stuffed shrimp are real Louisiana eats. What is Louisiana's most famous variety of peach? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Italian immigrants have left their mark on many communities in Louisiana, especially in New Orleans and the southeastern part of the state. But these families, many of whom were Sicilians, hailing from places like Palermo and Cefalù, also found their way to North Louisiana. Our Louisiana Eats roving reporter Chris Jay filed this report.
In Shreveport, there are Italian-owned fine dining establishments, a few historic sandwich shops with Italian roots, and a personal favorite of mine, Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop. Gullo's is an old-fashioned roadside produce stand that also serves plate lunches to go, and it's the only place I can think of that serves both chicken fried steaks and handmade cannoli. It's a little bit country, a little bit old country, and entirely unlike any other place in Shreveport. Teresa Gullo Hamilton, daughter of Gullo's founders John and Retha Gullo, still operates the business. As a child, she worked this land alongside her grandfather, a first-generation Sicilian immigrant and truck farmer.
We got up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the sun was light enough. Right, every summer, we got paid not by the hour, but we got paid by what we produced for him at the end of the day. Now, our days were over with about 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the morning because it got hot. And we would go in and my grandmother would cook a large meal up and he would sit down in his chair and watch as the world turns.
In 1981, Teresa's parents opened a fresh produce stand on Flournoy Lucas Road in South Shreveport. Aided by the popularity of Retha's home cooking, the roadside business soon began selling hot lunches as well. Today's Gullo's is still this interesting hybrid of produce stand and plate lunch house.
They actually started this business under a pecan tree with a card table and a few tomatoes on it. My mother, who had always been such a good cook, then she started making a few things to go out there. She found that the more she made, the more people bought, and it just grew and grew and grew.
When John and Retha both passed away in 2011 after 30 years in business, Teresa and her cousin Patricia were among the family members who banded together to keep Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop alive.
When your family's gone, the stuff that you took for granted just the daily stuff they did every day. The smells when you walk in that kitchen and you smell something and you think it brings you back 40 years ago, you know. It's pretty cool, I think.
It's still a family affair, as Teresa and Patricia are taking the opportunity to bring a new generation into the kitchen.
We're making them do it, whether they want to do it or they don't.
Yeah.
I mean,
when Craig would come home from college, I'm like, you got to work store this summer.
Well, I don't want to work store. I don't care. You're working a store. You can't be here if you don't work, okay? Like, that's just a deal we have.
If there's any dish that embodies the Gullo story of Sicilian immigrants becoming true blue Southerners, it's the family's recipe for cherry cannoli. Unlike many versions, which use ricotta cheese for the filling, the Gullo's version is filled with a simple custard flavored with chopped maraschino cherries. Biting into one for the first time, I crunched through the crispy pastry tube dusted with powdered sugar and into that custard filling, which instantly reminded me of every dessert my Arkansas-raised grandmother brought to family get-togethers.
I've met chefs from all over the place, you know, at different restaurants and stuff, and they all have that same basic ricotta cheese, and I'm like, where'd that come from? Because we didn't have that, you know?
I don't know if our relatives couldn't afford the cheese back then, and they just made it work with what they had.
We didn't have these all the time. Like, I don't remember my grandmother making these, like, just every Sunday or something. It was like a special occasion day when we had them.
Usually, when I stop in at Gullo's, I get one of their fantastic cheeseburgers and eat it at a picnic table in the pecan grove that surrounds the little shop. I can never help wondering how this place has hung on, even as more and more restaurants have opened nearby. Selling a box of cannoli here, a jar of Mayhaw jelly there, how do they do it? Maybe the better question is, why do they do it?
I've had people come along and say, why do you keep that place open? Why would we close this place? It's our family, you know. It's love. It's what we do. It's not about how much money you make, because I'm going to tell you, you're not getting rich here. It's just about what you do. So it's you know, when we do the traditional things like the St. Joseph spaghetti and stuff, it's all we can do to just keep doing that, because it's what keeps our hearts alive and keeps that stuff going within us.
For Louisiana Eats, I'm Chris J.
To find out more about what's happening in Shreveport, visit Chris J's blog at 20by49.com.
I have kissed you, so I'll miss you. On the road, I'll be wanting you. But I have you, cause I love you. And you have me, cause you love me too.
Talk to anyone in the spirits industry, and you'll learn that even 80 years later, we're still dealing with the damaging effects of Prohibition. As little as 2 years ago, brewers in Shreveport were still trying to deal with restrictive local laws that dated back before Prohibition. We met City Council Representative Jeff Everson outside of Herbie K's in Shreveport for the lowdown on how Shreveport breweries got caught up with the rest of the state.
You know, once we really started hearing from two breweries, one of whom is Great Raft, who really took the lead on a lot of developing the policy necessary to have a full-scale brewery, you know, we started working with them to find out what provisions are there in our local laws that don't allow this. And there were quite a few. There hadn't been a reason to review it in a long time. So this gave us that reason, and it gave us that chance to change the laws. So, you know, I think it is an important reminder for all of us to take a look at when industries evolve, that our laws need to evolve as well.
And evolve they did. Great Raft's co-founders, Andrew and Lindsay Nations, worked with Jeff to help clear out the cobwebs from 100-year-old regulations, consulting with everyone from police to city planners to fire marshals. By October of 2013, the restrictive zoning regulations were lifted, and change could begin.
When Great Raft finally had their products available for commercial sale, I did get the privilege of buying the first beer produced in Shreveport since Prohibition, and it was a brew that they call Reasonably Corrupt. It's a dark brew that has some pretty funny political connotations, but I took it as an honor, so it was a treat.
After chatting with Jeff, we had to check this place out.
Hey, how are you? So this is my first time here.
I barely tasted my first sampler of a fruity pale ale called Commotion when the bartender announced a guided tour was about to begin.
Hello, welcome to Great Raft. My name is Andrew Nations. We got some folks recording some audio. So this is awkward for me, but whatever. Well, thank you guys for coming out and taking the tour. What we'll do today is kind of tell you a little bit about what we believe in terms of brewing lagers, and kind of walk through the whole process of a typical brew day. Other than that, have fun. And again, ask questions. I like to talk about beer and drinking beer.
Andrew certainly didn't have the appearance of a founder and owner. He had on a baseball cap and was sweating a little bit more than the rest of us, probably because of the hot and humid nature of working in the brewery. But basically, he just looked like any of the patrons visiting the brewery that busy Saturday afternoon. There were twice as many people lining up for samples in the adjacent tap room as there were on the tour.
So the name Great Raft, for those of you who don't know, is a reference to the Great Red River Raft. Back in the 1830s, was basically a log jam, but it was 100 miles long. At one point, you could walk across the Red River because it was so dense with logs and debris.
That log jam was torn down with snag boats by Henry Miller Shreve, Shreveport's namesake. This opened up the Red River as a waterway and led to a period of prosperity for the city.
For my wife and I, we really wanted a name that resonated with locals and had something to do with local history beside, you know, Lindsay and Andy's Lane Brewery. So that's how kind of we came up with Great Raft.
Andrew then explained that Great Raft is classified as a production brewery, which means they can only sell 10% of their production on site. He also explained what it means to be a craft brewery. The key words here are small, independent, and traditional.
Small meaning under 6 million barrels a year. Independent meaning we're not owned by some massive conglomerate, Miller Coors, AB, some other out-of-country, out-of-state businessmen. It's just my wife and I and some other local businessmen that have a lot more money than I did. Traditional meaning we use traditional ingredients in all of our beer. We only add things in the beer that make it awesome and make it taste great and for the most part traditional.
Andrew has a real affinity for German beers. So if you're familiar with Schwarzbiers, the black beers with a chocolatey flavor, or light pale ales from the Spaten Brewery, then you'll like Andrew's palate. You won't be alone. Within their first 3 months of operation, Great Raft exceeded their expectations for the entire first year.
We're just trying to keep up at this point. We're making lager. It's not a fast turnaround. It's not as bad as bourbon, but it's still about a month, right? We can't rush that. The beer has to taste the same way every time you have it, but it's a struggle to keep up with Shreveport. We're very grateful to be working as hard as we are. We're expanding, and we'll get there.
Andrew makes about 700 gallons of beer every time they brew, about 40 kegs worth. In his pursuit of quality, he sources the finest ingredients from around the world, but has to use local water to produce his beer.
Let's talk about Shreveport water. So Shreveport water is crap. If you guys don't have a Brita filter, please go to Target, drop a 20, invest in your family's future. What that means for us is we have to control that, right? So we make light lagers. Like, again, that beer has to taste the same every time you try it. So we use a process called reverse osmosis.
What does that mean? The reverse osmosis process strips out the mineral content of the water, allowing Andrew to mimic the flavor profile of any water from around the world.
Dublin, Portland, Asheville, San Diego, if I have a water report, we have that flexibility. So we have different water profiles for our lager, different water profiles for our hoppy beer. But ultimately, in a nutshell, what it means is great control, right? We control our water regardless of what the city's doing, the algae bloom in the summer. It just gives us that control, and we really need that for doing light lagers like we do.
On a typical brew day, the head brewer will arrive around 8. And once the water reaches the proper temperature for brewing, he'll drop milled malted barley into a mixer. Here's what happens next.
So think about it this way. All we're trying to do in the mash mixer, we're converting the starches to sugars. So if you think about it, we've just added really, really hot water to this malted barley. It's a cereal grain, right? It gets kind of mushy, kind of like oatmeal. Well, I don't want oatmeal. I need somewhat clear sugar water. At this point, it's called a wort, unfermented beer.
The wort gets sent through a machine that separates the spent barley from the now flavored water, and it's on to the next step, balancing the beer.
Let me get a sip of beer. Let's not get crazy here.
Then the beer goes into a kettle for an hour-long boil, and hops are added to give bitterness to the beer. You'll get different flavors depending on how many hops you add. Hefeweizens won't have many hops, while a double IPA will wallop you in the face with their bitterness.
I want to pass around some hops here. This is American Simcoe hops. I love this hop. I can't get a lot of it because it's one of the sexy hops that you can't get. But really open it up, crack it open. You're trying to get your hands really sticky and smell that resin. The resin is the part that makes it, there's some orange juice in there. There's some orange zest, very tropical. But it really gives you an idea of what that hop is about. So there's different hops will give you onion, mint, spice. It's an open door. You can do anything you want to with hops.
Hops are usually added twice at this stage in the game. The first time for bitterness, the second for aroma.
So you ever seen the wine guys holding, like, don't do that because we're beer guys, right? It's very smart because they're getting air into that wine, right? They're getting some of that aroma because they know a large part of what you smell is how you perceive taste. Don't make a show out of it. Again, we're beer guys, but definitely pour your beer into a glass because we need that aroma to taste.
Once the hops have been added and the beer has cooled down, it's time for the fermenting to begin. This is when yeast is added to convert the sugars to alcohol.
Let's go down here and we'll talk about packaging.
If it were up to Andrew, he'd have everyone drink straight out of the tank. No such luck, though. Instead, like many craft breweries in Louisiana, Great Raft cans on site.
So we canned all day yesterday. It was pretty brutal, but we got 600 cases done. So cans for us, I mean, they're better for the environment. I don't think Shreveport even recycles glass, which is crazy. But cans are kind of a perfect vessel for us. You can take them on the golf course, on the boat, particularly in this part of the world. It's best for us.
At the tour's conclusion, we toasted Andrew's success with one of his delicious craft brews. I looked around the room and saw people playing a game of beanbag toss, dining at the food trucks out in the parking lot, and smiling over beers with folks they had just met. It made me think about something Jeff Everson had said hours before.
I really think that if you want people to move somewhere, stay there, be connected to it, feel a part of it, then you have to get them into the culture of the place. You feel a lot more of a part of your community when you're dining at places or hanging out in places that are telling a part of that story. And, you know, so it's both economically and socially vital.
Tours of Great Raft's brewery are provided regularly on weekends, and flagship beers like Southern Drawl Pale Lager can be found at retailers throughout Louisiana. For more information, visit greatraftbrewing.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we take a look at just what it takes to become a grown-up. Author Kelly Brown talks about a process she calls adulting.
I had this moment where all my furniture literally had dissolved in the rain because it was made of particle board. There was a storm when I was moving it. It all fell apart. And all I had around my house was these piles of clothing, like beanbag chairs, except made of my dirty clothes. And I just thought, whatever you're supposed to be doing, you are not doing it right now. Let's get it together.
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant, Tableau, serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.